From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We're going to start out with Robin Sachs. You know her as a former ADA author, victims advocate, co-host of the wildly popular blog talk radio show Justice Interrupted. She has the Sachs Facts Weekly. She's on all the cable news shows, and she is so kind to spend a few minutes of her time each week with us here. Hi, Robin.
Hello, how are you?
What's going on with you?
Oh, my goodness. It has been nonstop madness in the city of Los Angeles in the case of the alleged murder of Monica Beresford-Redmond, the survivor producer's wife, Ruth Beresford-Redmond. As you know, I am now an in-house legal analyst for NBC News, and we have been covering that case constantly. So I have been really busy. You know, Mexico's sleuthing here, and not on vacation this time.
You know, when you hear of a story like this, sad and all, and of course the Hollywood angle to it, but when you hear Mexico, red flags pop up right away. Is that just me, or is there something that makes us all a little bit skeptical when they come out with their side of the story?
Well, it's very interesting in terms of what you would think, what you would expect, and also kind of how the evidence has evolved or beginning to look like it's evolved over the course of time. Yes, whenever we hear of Mexico, the first thing you always think is, oh, no, because we've never really had an understanding that Mexico is synonymous with justice. However, you know, you can only think about sometimes the street justice that happens in Mexico to Americans, and one could only hope that that was what Ruth Beresford-Redmond was going to be facing, with maybe a little bit of Mexico street justice. But what it appears is he's getting, it looks like he's getting some street Mexico kindness, actually, because frankly, you know, you and I both know if any average American citizen were over in Mexico and committed so much as a traffic infraction, they could be dealing with, you know, a gun up some of their orifices and some trouble in a Mexican jail. But for whatever reason, well, we know potentially the reason, money talks there, and perhaps money has spoken, and that may have been what has kept Bruce Beresford-Redmond out of custody thus far. And we can only hope that through the simultaneous investigation that's going on here in Los Angeles and the advocacy on behalf of the Monica sisters, Carla and Gianni, that maybe we will see a little bit of justice prevail.
See, that's what makes you such a good NBC News analyst, is my next question was going to be the family of the victim. Are they running into roadblocks when it comes to the Mexican authorities?
Well, yes and no. You know, it depends who you ask. I think that the family here, you know, the family, the Monica's family is Brazilian, from Brazil originally. As a matter of fact, Monica owned a famous Brazilian nightclub restaurant here, wildly popular. So I think that there is a cultural sympathy with at least the Latina background that's giving the family a little bit of hope. But, you know, you never really can quite tell. You can have someone from the Mexican government look at someone straight in the eye and saying, we're doing everything we can, and then turn around hearing reports that they are willing to give the body, Monica's body, to Bruce, who has requested that it be cremated. So, you know, there's one, on one hand, you kind of hope for the best. On the other hand, you really can't tell, because there is so much corruption there that you just don't know who's been corrupted by who and who is part of which camp and who has been paid by who and so forth. And remember, Bruce was a survivor producer. And so his job was to make things happen in foreign countries. That's what he did, to get things done. And for Survivor, you learn how to negotiate with foreign countries and foreign customs, and you know how to, the power of the almighty dollar. And I believe, from everything that I've seen, is that it is no accident and no coincidence that they were in Mexico.
Now,
when she was killed.
Now, am I wrong, or is he? It's been a while since he's been involved with Survivor. True.
True. He has been a regular reality show producer. He produced Pimp My Ride. He's also was allegedly, I haven't confirmed this, but allegedly part of the Sarah Palin reality show that was underway. But, you know, once you learn the skills, it's like riding a bike, right?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I knew he was involved in one of those dopey shows, Tattooed Barbecues or something. But anyway, Robin Sachs is here. We're talking about the tragedy in and I keep using that term and I always hate it, in Mexico. But I also want to get an update from her, and she's blogged about it quite a bit on her website, robinsachs.com. Mr. Conrad Murray and wrongful death suits, him being able to prescribe drugs, his license, all sorts of things. Quite a few updates since we talked about him last.
Oh, yes. It was actually, I was in court in that case just last Monday. And let me tell you, I couldn't tell you from the outside of a courtroom if I was waiting for Michael Jackson to play Billie Jean or if I was going to actually see justice happen, because there were so many people gathered around that courthouse for what was really going to be a very unsubstantial, inconsequential kind of hearing, even though that there was talk of whether or not the judge was going to actually revoke Dr. Murray's license here in California. Really, it was just a setting of which court was which. And so far what we have is we do have here in Los Angeles a case where a judge has been actually assigned, going to the ninth floor in the criminal courts building. And the ninth floor, everyone is very familiar with the ninth floor. Even if you're not familiar with the ninth floor, you're familiar with the ninth floor, because the ninth floor is where the Specter trial was, the OJ trial. It's the long cause floor. It's the give it up for a long haul fight floor. And hopefully it'll be also synonymous with the guilty floor. But that is where the case will be heard, and we know that we're going to be going back in August, which is where everything has been basically tabled for. But there, despite what little is actually happening right now in Los Angeles, there always seems to be quite a lot happening around the case in every other way. There's so much to this case that on a daily basis you can't help but to open up, if not the paper, certainly open up TMZ and see some sort of update with which creditor is trying to sue the estate for which funds and where the Conrad Murray's license has been yanked from next. The recent reports is that Texas has restricted his use of propofol, although I'm not really that jazzed and excited about all this restriction on propofol. The guy is is a cardiologist who would never have reason to ever use propofol. So it's like saying, you know, oh, you can't use guns. Like, well, if you never used guns before, and that wasn't your weapon of choice, and it was just by happenstance, what kind of deterrent effect is that in terms of keeping people safe? So he's going to, you know, if he was put in a compromising position again and it's not propofol, would it be something else that he would prescribe? I don't know.
Yeah, it's like the judge that releases the drug dealer on conditions of not having in his possession any illegal narcotics. So it's just kind of silly. That's all I have to say. Robin Sachs is here, and we're talking a little bit of everything. In fact, TMZ has turned away from Conrad Murray a little bit, and poor Larry King is each and every segment on TMZ now. And I'll ask you this question, not necessarily about Larry King, whose show you've appeared on many times before, but how, as a news analyst, do you decide what story is important and what story isn't important? Like some of this Conrad Murray stuff, yeah, interesting, but there's a lot of other stories out there that I'd sooner hear about.
That's the biggest quandary when it comes to the role that I play in the media right now, because while I am there commentating, I have absolutely no decision-making power or choice power or production power in which stories are covered. And as like you, if I were had my druthers, there's about 100 other cases going on in Los Angeles that I would rather put some focus and media attention, and that's just in Los Angeles, not to mention cases everywhere else. You know, it's really about the interesting part is the two-way street that you and I talk about all the time. I mean, yes, there are all these cases of injustice, but really, you know, the media says, listen, we just listen to the ratings, and the ratings tell us what people like, and that's what consumers like, and we just give it back what the consumers like. But, you know, to me, consumers should the concerns about the everyday injustices, the things that happen in courtrooms that are not reported about. I mean, really, do we all need to worry about Conrad Murray? No, but no. That's the stuff that seems to make people go, you know, the ratings go through the roof. Whatever it is with Michael Jackson, I mean, it's, you know, it's like, it's crazy, and it speaks volumes when you see how many citizens took the day off. I mean, I was sitting there outside that courtroom, and I'm like, there was had to be over 100 regular citizens with signs and gloves and armbands and Michael Jackson hats and penny loafers and everything. I mean, and there was this one woman, she was wearing an MTA shirt, which is the uniform for the bus system here, and I'm thinking, this woman took her lunch break to come to this hearing. Are you kidding me? I mean, isn't there some dry cleaning errand you need to go to, or some grocery store errand that's more important than this?
Yeah.
Crazy.
No, exactly, and I understand ratings sell, and that's what the networks do, but it gets a little bit disappointing, and I actually feel sorry for Larry King with his with what's going on with him right now, because good grief, how much can you talk about the poor man's marital woes? But anyway, Robin Sachs is here, and we're talking about high-profile cases in the news, and her wildly successful radio show that she co-hosts with Stacey Dietrich on Sundays called Justice Interrupted, and you can find that by going to justiceinterrupted.com. And the last time you were on my show, we talked about your special on Justice Interrupted, where you would be featuring the case of a murdered Michigan mom, Renee Pagel. How did that go?
You know, it was an amazing show, and it just was an amazing case of, you know, injustice as we spoke about. But what was also so amazing was how many people did tune in from the community who cared. And you know, like reporters like yourself and Stacey and I, it's one thing to bring awareness to a situation, but it doesn't matter a whole heck of a lot if there's no one out there listening or doing anything about it. And we really saw through our numbers and through the activity in the chat room and so forth that there was a lot of involvement. And all we can hope is that hopefully with the pressure of social media and people working together, that there will be someone who's going to hold the authorities accountable for answers. That's all this family wants, is what happened? Has every stone gone unturned? I mean, at this point, it's, you know, not every case is going to lead to a prosecution, and certainly not every case is going to lead to a successful prosecution or conviction, but the closure and answers are so very important, so for people to be able to move on with their lives, and we hope that we are able to at least assist in that part.
Well, you're doing a good job, and what I like about it is that you and Stacey both have been there. There's nothing more annoying than to see the analyst or to see the commentator who may have the degree behind them or may have a certificate behind them, but they've never been in the streets and worked it. Like later on, I'll be interviewing Clint Van Zandt and talking about the anniversary of Waco and Oklahoma City. Well, you know, why is that important? Well, he actually negotiated with David Koresh, and he's got quite a story to tell. It's fascinating, and you've been there too. And I want you to, just before we end up, Robin, because I know you're busy, I want you to parallel a little bit, because you've been out of the courtroom for a while now as the prosecutor and more in the courtroom now as the analyst or as the reporter. Compare the two.
You know, I got to tell you, it's a little bit of a lonely world as a reporter. You know, when I wore my prosecutor suit, I always felt like I had my good suit on, that my it was, you know, undoubtedly I was doing the right thing all the time and always trying to do the right thing and was able to do the right thing. When you're in the media, your question of your motives get very questioned by people who want to give you information and so forth. And so it feels that we sit here and we talk about the power of the media all the time, but to me it's the pressure of the media. The pressure of media is it's a very tight area for me to walk, because I am very concerned about when I'm getting information or talking to people to make sure that the integrity of their statements are made, that their full sound bite is what's reproduced on television and not just a partial sound bite. And I'm not willing to give up my integrity just for some sort of, you know, piece of information. These are people's lives. But, you know, the goals of different people, you know, are different. And so it's hard, but I do think that when you can participate in a story and recognize where you can make a difference. It's in those situations. It's just as satisfying as getting a conviction.
Well said. Her website is robinsacks.com. Her radio show website is justiceinterrupted.com, and she's a regular here on the program. Thank you, ma'am. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Robin Sacks. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with another show regular, Susan Murphy Milano, talking about her new book called Time's Up. This is Dana Pretzer on The Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Welcome back to the program. Listen, Time's Up is up. It's here. Tell us about it.
It's out.
Yeah.
It's out. It's a book on what the most important key is in the book is the evidentiary abuse affidavit. Mm-hmm. You know, if Susan Cox, the missing Utah woman who disappeared on December 7th, or Stacey Peterson, yep, who's been gone since October of 2007, or Lisa Stebbick, a number of these women, alive and missing or unaccounted for, had done an evidentiary abuse affidavit, which is a document just like a will. They fill out the information, even if the police have never come to the home for an incident, if they've never had a report. They talk about the abuse, just a couple instances. They show a picture. They may gather some evidence, like a shaver of his and hers. She needs to have some things, too, DNA type of items. And it's all listed in the book. And then she pairs it. It's got to be witnessed and notarized, so you can get it done in a currency exchange, a bank, your church, because there are oftentimes a notary is right there. And then she reads that. Hopefully it's under 6 minutes. And she reads it. Again, it could be at a church, even if you live in a rural area, because churches oftentimes videotape now their sermons and put them on the internet.
Right.
Where you work, your computer from home. So the evidentiary abuse affidavit is in place. Should you go missing, should something happen to you. And it's important. Before you say, I'm leaving you, I'm divorcing you, I'm ending the relationship, you've got to get this book, because what it does is it keeps you 10 steps ahead of the offender. Because to me, in all of these cases, whether you're alive or whether, you know, your relative has been killed or, you know, something has happened to a loved one, what's important about this book is that it gives you your plan so that you know, because he often can tell what I call the smell change in the book.
Right.
And that's where he knows when you're up to something, you're doing something, you're planning, you know, you're on the computer too long, you're not as argumentative as you were with him before. So that's why this is so important now.
Yeah, well, the controlling male is just that, controlling. He's watching every move you make, and this is so important. It's a, I don't know, I'll use the term a diary of the abuse and something that can be helpful. How did you come up with the term Time's Up?
It's time's up. It's end. Let, yeah. You know, you've made the decision. You're going to leave. You don't know how to do it. Stop, you know, sitting there and thinking about, well, I don't know if I should or could. I love him so much. You know, Dana, you and I see this all the time.
Yeah.
These women love, and men, this happens to men too. They love the individual that they're with. They don't want to leave them. They don't want to lose them. And it's very difficult for them. If the person is abusive, if you are in fear for your life, you know, one of the best indicators is, when you feel unsafe, when you're just not sure. We're not seeing these women who are losing their lives. They're not what we used to see, black and blue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in January, there was a woman who wrote Mr. Bean's birthday story, and she had two children, both autistic, attractive, lived in a gated community in Florida, and she and her children were killed by her husband. And what was interesting about that is he had kind of set up his own defense and said, or friends and relatives had said, I'm sorry, that he was losing it, mentally not stable. Great defense for a good defense lawyer to have. It's kind of already set the stage. Abusers are clever at telling stories. They're clever at setting up the victim and saying, oh, she's crazy, she's on drugs, she's, you know, seeing a therapist, she's not right. They've already kind of predetermined so that nobody responds to that person, or they move them away from their family and friends. So this book pretty much gives you everything. And, yes, your time's up. If you're in a fearful relationship, if you're in a relationship that's volatile, that you just don't know, if you do start to file for divorce, just do it as a precaution, if anything else. And it's on SusanMurphyMilano.com. We have the video for you as an example. It's a reenactment of an actual case that we do oftentimes across the country. And Neil Shorey, who was pastor to Stacey Peterson, wife number four of Drew Peterson, he's involved in this project as well. We're doing these evidentiary abuse affidavits all over the country.
You know, and you make a good point when you bring up the names, and we're not picking on people just named Peterson, but Drew Peterson, Scott Peterson are two big cases that the media followed. You know, the scourge of domestic violence is an epidemic across North America, actually across the world, but it seems like the media will only cherry pick certain cases and follow them. But where I find fault with that, Susan, is that it looks more at the offender, more about Drew Peterson, more about Scott Peterson. Yes, that's important, but we don't hear much about the victim, the victim's families, or the abuse that they go through. Tell us a little bit about how your book, Time's Up, will give, I guess, a heads up to those that are in domestic violence relationships, and some of the tips and the, I guess, like a shopping list of things that they need to do so they can protect themselves and their children.
Well, evidence on the fly. You know, if you're on the run, if you're preparing to leave, you need to gather important evidence. You know, the first chapter is about fear, which is really, it stands for facilitating ending the abusive relationship. You have to be the facilitator of this. So you are the advocate for yourself. You also try to gather friends and family. You have to be very careful about doing that because, as we all know, a lot of times people don't know what's going on because no one really talks about it. And unknowingly or unsuspectingly, the person whom you're a relative with or a friend with might go to the abuser and say, hey, I'm just trying to save your marriage, bud, here.
Yeah.
She's thinking of leaving you.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't tell people around you what's going on, you then, it catches on. It takes on a life of its own, and it can become dangerous. And you also have to, it talks about being mindful of technology, GPS systems, cell phones, Google address searches. You now have information at your fingertips. When you're calling to cancel your simple as a cell phone or your cable television, what these companies do is, without your knowledge, even though you're saying, you could say, let me speak to a supervisor, my life is in danger, I can't have any recordings going to my home that I'm canceling your service, I can't have any mail coming here saying that we're ending or transferring our service. This book has all of those guideposts to look for. When you're doing this, when you're contemplating it, you may not be able to leave for a year. Maybe your credit's really bad. Maybe you can't get an apartment. All of that's laid out in how to do it, to rebuild yourself so you can do this, so that you don't follow these these issues that come up in your life. Also, mm-hmm. You know, be mindful too. Simple thing, Dana, a survey. You take a survey. Oh, I'm going to answer the survey online or on the phone. Maybe it's the abuser or an abuser's friend.
Yeah.
Maybe you put in a code word that he would know or a password or a screen name. All of that's in there. Maybe you're getting ready to go the night before the kids have the flu. Or the neighbor's right there and he's friends with your husband or your wife. And you're packing up, you're going, and they say, here, let me help you. What are you doing? Well, what do you do? The book guides you through all of that as much as possible. It's as we've talked about before on the show. You got to have a plan B and a plan C.
Yeah, absolutely, and a D. Susan Murphy Milano is here talking about her new book, Time's Up. Susan, we've mentioned the term cycle of violence many times on this program. We've talked about it. I've talked about it to many guests besides yourself, and the cycles where. And old-time cops like myself see it, too. You go to a domestic situation one day, the next day, wife is right back with the husband, and you're scratching your head wondering, why would they ever do that? Now, we can sit back and say why, but I think you can explain why.
You know, let's take my mom, because that's the best example I know. You know, she loved this man. She was married to him for a long time. She's also fearful, because in some way he says, you know, it's not a really good idea for you to do this. She has heard this person say, if you leave, I'll find you. If I find you, if I kill you. The abuser is clever at bringing them back. You know, they have this narcissistic behavior. They have this great storytelling ability. They have this ability to make the world believe they are the wonderful guy next door who will go in and save the old lady in the burning fire. But in reality, they are not. People like my father, 4 years, was able to mask behind who he really was not. The world saw him as one wonderful, decorated police officer, and we knew him as someone else. In these families across the country, they know a different story. And because we don't have things on television, on the crime shows, we're inundated with this. We see these women being killed. We read about them. We don't read about her, but we read about what he was, what he was like, how he played ball on the team with everybody. Over the weekend in Flagstaff, Arizona, there was a veteran cop of 22 years, state police. He shot and killed his wife and then took his own life. all I saw was a glorified obituary. I did not see anything about the relationship. In another part of the United States, I don't recall where, but Jeffrey Glahn had murdered his wife, not only his wife, but two of her companions, and they were out for a Friday evening. They had divorced a year before. Everybody in the department knew what was going on. The sister had said something's going to happen to her, and there wasn't a lot anybody could do the night that they were all killed. He was angry that the friends had helped her. He was angry. So you have to be very careful. And you also have to know, and my mother did mistake. I mean, she moved too close to my father, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. She didn't move far enough away. She didn't sever all the ties. In some way, they're afraid, but they're also feeling kind of happy and secure that they're away from them. But being away from them just gives the abuser more time to formulate a plan of his attack. And women aren't, you know, think about this for a moment. We all, women have children. You know, they give birth. How is it that we're so quickly able to forget the pain of that childbirth? Is it the same thing with love?
Yeah. No, and you make a good point. Susan Murphy Milano is here. Tell us a little bit about your Blog Talk radio show. I've listened. I'm a regular listener, and you do a great job. What's it all about?
Well, it's for victims and their families. It's women who, you know, have a story to tell. A lot of times we see women who lose custody of children. We put experts on who are kind of outside the norm of what you would hear from because they're out in the trenches all over the country. We try to provide information that's useful and resourceful. And at the same time, you know, we give an hour show on 3 o'clock Central Time on Wednesday afternoons because 15 minutes sometimes, you know, that's not enough time to really get into a discussion, take phone calls. And it's kind of your way to get, it's not really, it's information that you can use. It's topics that you wouldn't read about because the media is so quick, as you know,
yeah,
with just 30-second sound bites. You know, we watch these shows and boom, it's over with. Well, what do we really know about them or an issue or how we can help in a school or in our home or in our community? So that's really what the show is about. It's guests that are pretty lively, and I'm probably more engaging with them because I can say and do what I want on that show. And it's interesting also because what results out of this is a lot of people come and send emails or they come and listen and they get information. A lot of times I'll just send people PDFs of the Time's Up book if they need it. This is about saving lives, this whole thing, and I've been doing this 20 years. I can't believe how much time has passed. Yesterday happened to be my mother's birthday. That's when we launched the book.
Right.
And, you know, she didn't ask this world to be, you know, for her to be taken at such a young age. She was only 47 years old. I lost my life. I lost my country when she died.
Yeah.
And that's why this book is 20 years in the making of actual hands-on cases, whether these women have been murdered alive, survived. There's success survivors in the book. What's interesting about it is that this is from women's lives. And people who have passed, their family members have sent me boxes of things almost forensically so I could look through, piece apart the case, and see what's necessary. I also still work on cases with prosecutors across the country. I'm teaching now a lot of law enforcement. I'm doing a lot of legal continuing education, podcasts, webcasts, and just taking that experience and that knowledge and everything that's going on and putting it out there. I just don't talk about a case. I'm intimately usually involved in them. Just like, you know, everybody that you have on the show, Robin Sachs, Stacey Dietrich, Clint Van Zandt, you know, Texas EquiSearch, we're all involved in everything that we do every day. That's why we're able to come out and talk about it so passionately, because we see it 24/7.
And that's what we do differently than some of the mainstream media and the cable news media especially. And I guess my last question to you is, I'm so disappointed in some of the crime shows lately because we have so many victims out there, Susan, you know this, that would kill for, and I don't mean that term facetiously, and I'm being silly when I use it, for 5 minutes of time to try and find their missing loved one. But we're seeing Nancy Grace cover John and Kate, and that's not crime, that's nonsense. And it seems like, yeah, the public interested in it, but those types of shows are losing their direction or forgetting what they're really about. Nobody wants to hear about Kate Gosselin and Dancing with the Stars and her custody on the Nancy Grace show, or am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right, and that's why we're developing a new show called Crime Wire with Vito Colucci, who people may know from Fox News, from Bill O'Reilly. He's a private investigator, as well as Denny Griffin, who is a writer, author, and former state police officer as well from New York. And so it's the three of us, and hopefully we're going to have an internet site where at least people can put the information up about the cases, because that's part of it. The internet is your best voice box.
Yeah.
The internet, you know, when we see these children missing, well, they didn't get the Amber Alert. Like, they found Nadia Bloom today about an hour ago.
Oh, really? Okay.
You know, she was found alive in the woods, mosquito bitten. She looked okay, but they didn't want her to walk, so they were carrying her around in a stretcher. They found her, though. Then there wasn't an Amber Alert issued for her, but yet the internet was inundated with, where is she?
Yeah.
Web Sleuths is also a great place for you to post information and to see cases. You know, you've got the PetersonWordPress.com or PetersonStoryWordPress.com. You've got these sites following these cases, and you have your site on Scared Monkeys, where people can go and interact with each other. That's where the communities are really going. That's where the information's going. So hopefully with CrimeWire, we don't have an official date yet, but we do have an official date for our show, which is May 4th is when it begins. I want to say 8 o'clock Eastern, or 9 o'clock Eastern, I'm sorry. You know, that's for cases, specifically, where we're going to take two cases, really get into them, but then there'll be an interactive site on the internet, because that's where people are going. They're kind of not sitting in front of a television like they used to. They're interacting in the internet community.
That's right, that's for sure. Anyway, the book is Time's Up. The author is Susan Murphy Milano. Her webpage is SusanMurphyMilano.com. Thanks, Suze. Talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Okay,
bye.
Bye-bye. And this is the Dana Pritzer Show. We'll be right back.
We'll be back with more of the Dana Pritzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio.
The crime dog?
Yep.
I think I'm going to need your help. I've got an internet bully.
Okay, well, what to do is...
Maybe you could put a virus on her computer, or a tracking device, or a bug.
You don't have to do that, are you?
Or maybe we could get an attack dog. You ever see those attack dogs that can, like, rip a person's arm off? Seriously. Or like a SWAT team, a cyber SWAT team or something. Or like an army. Did you ever see that zombie army movie? We should get a zombie army.
Wait. All you need to do to stop an internet bully is delete their messages and never forward them on.
So, no zombies?
No zombies.
Bummer.
Delete cyberbullying. Don't write it. Don't forward it. For more information, visit ncpc.org. A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
About 2 or 3 months ago, I started having money problems. Ever since then, I've had a pretty hard time keeping up with the bills. The worst part is I can't make the house payments. So when the phone started to ring and I knew it was the mortgage people calling, I didn't pick it up. I just couldn't. And the notices were coming in the mail, too. Lots of them. Now I may lose my house, and I don't know what to do.
If you're facing foreclosure, doing nothing only puts you deeper in the hole. Now's the time to dig yourself out. Call 1-888-995-HOPE today. That's 1-888-995-4673. Because nothing is worse than doing nothing. A public service announcement brought to you by NeighborWorks, the Ad Council, and this station.
At the holiday party, Chris shows the telltale signs of being wasted. He tells his boss, the one about the salesman in the talking bar stool. Laughing, he excuses himself to hit the head. He decides a plant will do just fine. Chris misses the plant. Finished, he raids the company fridge and eats 27 deviled eggs while drinking the special punch nicknamed Rocket Fuel. He makes out with Kathy from accounting. He decides to make a funny holiday card. Sitting on the copying machine, Chris laughs hysterically. He writes, "Happy holidays from Stinky the Elf." He then yells, "Office parties are for losers." It's easy to tell
tell if you've had way too many to drive. But what if you've had just one too many to drive? Never underestimate just a few. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, the Ad Council, and this station.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
All right, we're back. This is the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. My name is Dana Pretzer. This Monday, April 19th, will be the 17 and 15-year anniversaries of the death and destruction that occurred at the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, and the Alfred P. Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma. My next guest, you know, Clint Van Zandt, was involved in both of those situations. Hi, Clint.
Hey, good evening, Dana.
Wow, 17 years, 15 years. It doesn't seem like that. I'm sure in your mind it's just like it was yesterday.
Yeah, it is just like it was yesterday. I mean, you know from your law enforcement career, there are some things that just hang with you all the time, and both of those incidents were just, you know, were major markers for America, for the FBI, and, you know, they just kind of stick in your craw. I mean, they both represent a sad loss of life that, you know, in my mind, shouldn't have happened. They're just, there's got to be other ways to resolve situations, and on both of those cases, unfortunately, either the government failed or the American public as citizens, we failed.
Absolutely. You know, when you look at Waco, for example, go back to, say, Jonestown, Jim Jones. Here we have Koresh, a different situation, obviously, but portrayed in the media similarly as this charismatic leader who begins to brainwash his followers. Waco turned out to be a disaster. Let's talk about your involvement in that.
Yeah, well, as you know, back in the FBI, I was a hostage negotiator. I ran the FBI's hostage negotiations program for a while, and I had already, in my case, I had gone over to the behavioral science unit and was doing profiling, and Waco went down, and, you know, in all honesty, there was part of me that was just glad it wasn't on my watch. I mean, I saw Waco as a train wreck. I mean, from the time it went down, the original confrontation between agents of ATF and the Branch Davidians, I mean, it shouldn't have happened that way. It shouldn't have gone down that way. And then there were time after time in the first couple of days, there were just, you know, major mistakes made that it frustrated the whole situation. And then I got a call asking me to go and be the headquarters negotiations coordinator. And as you and I know, you go. You pack your bag and go. And when I got to Waco, you know, obviously the confrontation had happened. There were deaths and injuries on both sides. Federal agents had been killed. Members of the Branch Davidian cult had been killed. This is obviously a situation you and I could talk about for hours. As you know, ATF had an undercover agent inside the compound. The Branch Davidians had figured out who he was. When he left, the Davidians assumed that they were going to be under some type of confrontation or assault by ATF. They went to guns. In a situation like that, you know, the three things that we know we need are speed, surprise, and violence of attack. Mm-hmm. And the government, ATF, didn't have any of those three going for them. They weren't fast enough. They didn't have the element of surprise, and the Branch Davidians were as violent, if not more violent, based upon the firearms they had. And a terrible situation took place. And then, you know, the FBI was called in, and we were kind of like the individuals, you know, with the shovel walking behind the elephant in the circus parade. You had to clean up whatever fell. And, you know, in all honesty, and I was part of it, I mean, we went in there, and I think we just exacerbated an already challenged situation. In my case, running the negotiations, I mean, we tried. We had hundreds, or literally I think it was like 850 individual telephone negotiation sessions with members of the Branch Davidians. As you know, I spoke personally with David Koresh and worked so hard to try to get him out of there, but in his case, he just frustrated every attempt that we made to try to talk him out, and you know, that terrible decision was made, obviously, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, to introduce gas after a couple of months into that compound, and that just further provoked the Davidians. Then they set the building on fire, and I could just, you know, it was, you say 17 years, Dana, and it was like it was yesterday. I mean, I can still see that smoke rolling off of that ugly, black, billowing smoke and fire. And it wasn't just fire, it was the tremendous loss of life. And inside that Davidian compound, even though the Davidians set the fire, you know, the federal government, we provided some of the fuel for that fire. And I don't, you know, do I blame it on the Davidians? Sure. I mean, they lit the match. But could the government, could the FBI, should we have handled it differently? You know, I mean, people died. Yeah, with that many people dead, there hasn't been a day in 17 years that I wish that situation would have gone differently. And, you know, even though some of us saw it coming and said, if in fact the tactical side of this operation attempts to force the Davidians out, you know, in fact, we wrote an analysis. We said they will burn this place. They will blow the place up and burn it to the ground. There'll be a mass suicide, and the government will get blamed. And we wrote that a week in advance, and then we stood there and saw that acted out. So, yeah, that and I guess what it gets to me, Dana, as a father, as a grandfather, as a human being, you know, it's one thing if adults make a decision to die, to take their lives, to whatever it is. That's an adult decision, even though I think it's a bad decision.
Yep.
But the adults inside that compound made that decision for their children.
Yeah.
And I just I think that's a terrible, you know, refusal to accept our responsibility as parents when we take the lives of our children in a horrible situation like that.
Absolutely. Clint Van Zandt is here. You can learn more about his article on the anniversary of Waco and Oklahoma City by going to clintvanzandt.newsvine.com. Let's talk about Koresh and your encounters with him. You sit down as a hostage negotiator, and you are trying to negotiate a peaceful end. That's the goal.
Sure.
of a hostage negotiator. But talking to someone like this isn't like talking to a strung-out, or maybe it is, person on heroin who's robbing a liquor store and has a hostage who is desperate. You're talking to someone who is, well, for lack of a better term, nuts.
Well, you know, any hostage negotiator, anybody who studied that, you know that one of the things you're trying to do is offer that person safety, security, a way out.
Yep.
And Koresh didn't want a way out. I think Koresh's master plan was that he was going to die and that everybody in that compound was going to die. Well, when you can't even offer somebody safety, security, the promise of life, the safety of the children inside, when all of those things are refused, you know, really the only thing Koresh wanted was attention. And, you know, we gave that to him.
Yep.
We gave him media attention. We gave him access to the media. I mean, we tried so many different ways. I remember just leaving a compound, that area, one day and going out and meeting with a local radio personality who really didn't like the federal government at all. And yet, you know, he was respected by Koresh, and he and I are standing on this windswept dirt road, this connection between two roads that happened to pass where we agreed to meet. And we stood there and kind of sized each other up, and in about an hour or so conversation, he said, you know what? He said, I really believe you. He said, I believe you're honestly trying to get those people out of there alive. And he said, in my radio broadcast, he said, I will tell Koresh to listen to you and to trust you. And, I mean, that was a tremendous hurdle to get someone like that to come on board with us. But, again, no matter who sent that message, Koresh didn't want to hear it. And I think that was the frustrating thing, Dana. You know, when I've talked bank robbers and, you know, other people into surrendering and coming out again, you had something to offer them.
Yeah.
You had, you know, your life. You know, the bottom line for a hostage negotiator many times is surrender or die. I mean, sometimes those are the choices. But With the case of Koresh, we offered so many modifications to that, to work with the people inside. We made so many approaches, but you've got to realize that the Branch Davidians inside that compound, by and large, all of the men had given, I'm talking in a physical sense, had given their wives, their daughters, over to Koresh. Koresh was the only person who could have sex with the women inside the compound, because he had created this deity figure that he was. That he told me head-to-head in our negotiation session, he was Christ.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got... Did he believe that? I don't know that he necessarily believed it, Dana. You know, there was this... He was this functional psychotic. There was this quasi-delusional system. But it was something, and I think it's an interesting analogy you make with Jim Jones. There was part of Koresh that used that to manipulate and control people. And I guess my point is, when you give up your family members, in this case men giving up their wives and their daughter, when you give all that up in a physical and emotional and a spiritual sense to this guy who tells you he's Christ and you believe him, it's hard to say, holy cow, we made a mistake. You know, let's back up a step and let's try something different. I mean, these people had bought into Koresh and they really weren't in a position to change their minds. And I think all of that contributed to that final terrible day that we saw, where that fire just basically consumed the vast majority of the people and those poor kids inside that compound.
Absolutely. So sad. Clint Van Zandt is here. Let's talk a little bit about McVeigh and Oklahoma City, Clint.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at, and I'm going to use the term ideology, of the Timothy McVeighs out there, and parallel it to today with some of the anti-government hatred and the nuts that are out there, is there a comparison? Are we bound to see another Timothy McVeigh or a situation like that with the hatred for the federal government that's there, or am I exaggerating?
No, I don't think you're exaggerating, Dana. I think we see various levels. You know, as you know, I do a lot of television interviews. I mean, I was on MSNBC last night talking about a individual who had confronted a census taker. The census taker came on his property, and a guy goes out and fires a shotgun over the census taker's head, chasing him off his property. Well, you know, had he lowered his aim about 10 feet or so, he would have taken the head off this census taker. There are people that, you know, they believe in black helicopters, they believe in conspiracies, they hate the government, they don't want any government intervention in their lives. They don't want to fill out the census forms. They don't want to pay taxes. I mean, these are all responsibilities that we have, whatever nation we're a citizen of. We still have these responsibilities that go along with the benefits. And, you know, when people, number one, refuse that responsibility, and number two, make a decision that they're going to take up arms against their government, well, you know, we know about Oklahoma City because of that building was blown up, because it was a media event, because we saw all those people die. But, you know, just as I think the federal government, you know, contributed to what happened at Waco, I think the media, I think talk radio, I think that television anchors, but whoever chair these various programs on TV, that, you know, whether it's, you know, Fox on one side or MSNBC on the other or CNN somewhere in the middle, these various talk show hosts are taking very strong positions on issues. There are government representatives that are taking tremendously strong positions on issues. I mean, you know, in America, we are a nation divided. We are red and blue states. We are conservative and Republicans. Are conservatives, Republicans, we're liberal Democrats. My challenge in this country right now is that there is this you're either with us or against us mentality, and we have drawn a line almost like in the Civil War in this country. And I think we're going to see individuals who, you know, there are a lot of people who sit on the edge of the abyss psychologically to begin with. And I think a lot of these talk show hosts walk by and push people over the edge. They give them so much negative information. They get them fired up so much that there are the people in the world, like this guy who fired the shotgun over the census taker's head, like Timothy McVeigh, who in their own mind already have some bone to pick with government. But then they watch their favorite show that gets them riled up every night, many times with stories that are simply untrue. And that's just enough sometimes to push that person over the edge. So, you know, are there Timothy McVeighs in the wings? I absolutely believe there are.
Yeah.
And when these situations happen, that's when you see all these television and radio and newspaper writers and talk show hosts, oh, no, not my fault, not my fault. Well, it is if you provide stories that are developed to fire people up, to get them rallying for one point or another, and many times push them over the edge. I mean, we've got to be careful about that. And in this country, in America, we're doing the exact opposite. We are becoming so polarized, and the media is a strong point of that polarizing force.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Clint. I appreciate your time.
Good to be with you.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Clint Van Zandt, retired FBI agent and someone who was there at Oklahoma City and Waco. And polarization, call it what you want. I'm not saying Rush Limbaugh is inciting someone to go out and blow up a federal building. Of course he isn't. And he has a right, and so does everyone else that follows his thinking, and I'm one of them, to voice that opinion. But we have to be very careful, because there are the McVeigh types that are out there that are just looking for that little bit of fuel to add to their psychotic fire. And if we can't protect our own, who can we protect? My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. My next guest will be part of the Zimmer Children's Museum Show and Tell, The Art of Knowledge, and we'll have an exhibit there at the Bell Family Gallery, say that three times real fast, from April 29th to June 3rd, 2010. This year's theme of knowledge inspired many artists, and many chose to incorporate objects associated with school and education, like a globe, a pencil, a ruler, light bulb, a dictionary. And, of course, we're talking about Randy Tatt. It's always nice to have you back on the show, sir.
Great to be here. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
A little bit of everything, because the time zones are all over the place. Tell us about your involvement with the Art of Knowledge, and then we'll get into that character named Desi.
Sounds great. Fortunately, every year I've been invited to be a part of their show. This year they have 30 artists that will be exhibiting different pieces of artwork. Some are paintings, sculptures, ink drawings. I created a sculpture, which has been a lot of fun and a great challenge.
Now, I'm looking at some of the pictures here. You were kind enough to send them to me, or pictures of the exhibits, and it's great. I want to ask you this question, and I think I've asked you this before when you've been on the program. When you have an art exhibit like this, and again, for more information, you can go to the webpage at ZimmerShowAndTell.org. How do you compete with today's, the technology, the multimedia, all that sort of stuff that's going on? Because it's got to be, for those that are uninformed and for those that don't appreciate the work that you and the other artists do, it's got to be somewhat difficult.
I mean, it's definitely a challenge. I mean, I look at all the other artists, and there's some very prominent, well-known people that, you know, have been painting or creating artwork for years. What I try to do is, when I'm given a theme or I'm contracting a piece for a family or a corporation, I just try to think of how to really utilize all my skills, all the tools that are available to me, and come up with something that hopefully will be different and unique and create a thought, an idea in people. I mean, I want to evoke an emotion from someone that's viewing a piece of my art.
And how great is that when you incorporate the theme of knowledge and try to get those that are watching or looking at that piece to think a little? You came up with the self-made man. Let's talk about him. He's been all over the place.
He has. It's been a lot of fun. I've had a great time doing this. I was trying to think of something interesting, something that was organic, something that I could use recycled material, and I came up with a concept. I built this 5-foot-tall wooden sculpture of this man that has, it's made out of thick plywood, and each limb is fastened together by these nuts and bolts, these screws. So his limbs, you know, they're fastened with these metal screws, so he can assume any position. His character, the name is Desi, the self-made man. I think, therefore, I am all that I can be. I've used, it's an assemblage, mixed media. The materials were recycled, vintage books, acrylics, waters, and oil paints. Basically, you know, he's also constructed with recycled wood, aluminum. The vintage self-help books are decoupage onto his body. It's an original mind-body duelist. He's distressed. He has hologram eyes. He's wearing a red Kabbalah bracelet. There's a clear vase with fresh flowers on his lapel and a peace sign around his neck. It's just a lot of fun, and he captures the modern society's continual evolution. He's a thought-provoking pop icon representing man's thirst for knowledge and self-expression. There's all sorts of great books. I mean, there's Dale Carnegie's classic, The Power of Positive Thinking, How to Win Friends and Influence People, I'm Okay, You're Okay, Creative Visualization, Jonathan Livingston Siegel. Really fun books and all sorts of great messages on his body. Between his eyes, there's an aluminum, the letter I. So you have I, and then all these great words. I am, I can, I will be, I want, I desire, I know. On his arms, empowerment, strength. So it's a real cathartic piece of art that you can learn, and it, again, evokes a lot of great thoughts.
Well, yeah, exactly, and it's fascinating to learn about it, and I hope more people will check it out. Where can they find out more information about the exhibit, Randy?
Well, the opening of the exhibit is Thursday, April 29th from 6 to 9 p.m., but the exhibit does last from the 25th to June 3rd. At the Zimmer Museum, as you mentioned earlier. If you want any more information on the exhibit, it's www.zimmershowandtell.org. It's going to be a lot of fun. The most important thing is all of the art will be auctioned off and the proceeds will be going to an organization called YouThink, which is an innovative education outreach program developed with the Center for American Studies and Cultures. And they use the power of art to foster critical thinking, engage diverse learners, promote literacy, and serve as a tool for social change. They offer school services with the proceeds and art-based lessons in California public schools. It's a great cause, and all these artists, you know, have been very generous in donating their work and their time to such an amazing organization.
Yeah, sounds great. Again, the website is zimmershowandtell.org. Put three W's in front of that, and the exhibit will be from April 29th to June 3rd with a preview week and pre-sales from April 25th to 29th. Thank you, Randy.
Sounds great. Just one more thing.
Sure.
I just wanted to let you know, if you want to see more of my art, you can go to www.tatonthewall.com or www.tagmyspace.tv.
Sounds great. Thank you, Randy.
Thanks so much for your time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care.
And make sure and check out that exhibit. If you're in Beverly Hills, California, go there directly. If not, check it out online. All the proceeds go to a good cause. That's it. That's tonight's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Check out our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. We'll see you again next time here on The Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.